And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. Well, it turns out that climate change, as you probably well know, is such an enormous topic that covers so many issues and has so many perspectives. Sometimes it's good to step back and think of what are different ways to grab a hold of the question of climate change. One of them is to think about the supply side and the demand side in climate change. So if we're talking about demand side in climate change, that's generally things like turn off the lights in your house, reduce your demand for fossil fuels, get an electric car. You're reducing your demand for fossil fuels. And eventually part of that dream is that by reducing demand, fossil fuels go away. The other side of that coin and that particular kind of narrow way of thinking about climate change issues is the supply side. That is to say, the people that are making the fossil fuels. And on the supply side, you have, from a climate activist point of view, you have the keep it in the ground folks, right? Don't take it out of the ground. You have Bill McKibben pushing the financial side. You have divestment work. One of the big methods for suppressing the supply side of the climate question is to reduce the infrastructure, to stop building new infrastructure. That is to say, pipelines and stuff that are going to be hanging around for 60 or 70 years, right? Just don't build those things. So there's a pushback. And that sort of supply side work to stop the supply of fossil fuels has been going on for going on a decade now. Many people remember Standing Rock, in Nevada, the pipeline that was going through Nevada. There's been a long history of these things, and it's going to continue. So it's good for people to know about what goes on in stopping a particular kind of fossil fuel infrastructure. Here in Massachusetts, we're wrestling with the Weymouth compressor. We're wrestling with the Peabody peaker plant, both of which are infrastructure that we don't want to build. Anyway, it turns out that in Minnesota, there is a important, not just exemplary, but also critically important pipeline that has been proposed and is being challenged. It's called Line 3. So you might have seen some of this floating around in the news very occasionally or on your social media feeds. But Line 3 is a pipeline up in Minnesota that is scheduled to, it's like mostly built, but there's a section that is still being contested and still being opposed. This pipeline will carry tar sands from Alberta down to Lake Superior. The tar sands, if you remember, I'm old enough to remember Jimmy Carter touting tar sands, which were going to be the magic solution for all. And tar sands, of course, are basically picking up sand. And then you have to put so much energy to boil out the tar and get to the oil. It's terrible, terrible stuff. But this is a pipeline to carry those tar sands across the Canadian border into the United States. And it's going to last forever. And of course, that pipeline crosses the Mississippi River. It crosses indigenous treaty lands, freshwater things that are preserved and perfect now and then become at risk of being poisoned. So there's many, many, many topics around this. So that is why we are thrilled to have with us someone who actually knows what he's talking about, as opposed to somebody who's read about it in the paper. We are joined by Sasha Lewis-Norell, who works with Sunrise St. Paul in Minnesota. So he's there. He's on the leadership team for these issues for the 350 Minnesota. We have a 350 MA. This is 350 MN. So, Sasha, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This is, you know, a really important fight that, you know, in Minnesota has so much attention. It feels like this is the number one environmental and climate justice issue. But, you know, we really want to make sure that folks all across the country are hearing all about this, because, you know, Line 3 is, in our eyes, one of the biggest climate justice issues in the country right now. I really appreciate the context that you gave. And if you'd like, I can, you know, go ahead and give a bit more on top of that.
So, I mean, did I get it right? Or how would you critique what I said? And please tell me the story. What's at risk in Minnesota now? Why should people care about this?
Yeah, I mean, I would also say that, like, we can't just confine it to the risks in Minnesota. Like, those are very real, but this is moving, you know, tar sands oil to be exported to the, you know, the national and world economy. It's going to be, you know, having huge climate implications for many decades if it's allowed to operate at the scale that it is looking to operate. But just to give a bit more context as well. So Enbridge, the company that is building Line 3, is touting it as a replacement project because there is or was a Line 3 pipeline that was built in 1968. It operated until, you know, early 2010s or so, and then was shut down because there was, you know, way too many like leaks and structural integrity issues. And so in 2014, Enbridge proposed the Line 3 replacement project. But here in Minnesota, we really try and call out the fact that it is an expansion project. It is not just a replacement project. They are doubling its capacity. And so, you know, they will be moving a lot more oil than they have been in recent years. And again, this is moving tar sands oil, which is one of the dirtiest fossil fuels out there. And they'll also not really be doing much to really get rid of the old pipeline. They're changing parts of the route. Okay. And with the old pipeline, their plan is to, you know, turn it off, like clean out some of the oil, clean out the oil and leave it in the ground, basically. Yeah, so they're not even taking it out. So they're not replacing anything. They're adding a new pipeline, leaving the old one in there. And if there's any mess to get cleaned up later, it'll be up to Minnesota taxpayers to fund that.
I mean, it's a fascinating like case in point. I mean, if you're saying the original pipeline was built in 1968, which is a long time ago, right? And so the pipeline being built now would project forward into the 2070s, right? And the, I mean, I hate to use the word deception, but I mean, corporate speak is just like so full of spin, right? And so they're calling it a replacement, but in fact, they're increasing the capacity and then they're going to go try and, yeah, I mean, it is deception in many ways. So there you go. This is tar sands, which I say is a terrible thing. What's the state of play now?
Yeah, so at this point, construction is more or less complete for the most part. There are still some pump stations that need to be finished up and a lot of testing that goes into it, but it's expected that it'll be operational by the end of the year. Construction started last December after the final permits were approved through the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We were able to fend off construction for around 7 years, which was really, really, really impressive through the work that was done, you know, on the ground and in the courts and in the permitting system. Minnesotans really made it clear that, you know, we by and large do not want this pipeline, but we're still undermined by our public agencies, which is really unfortunate to see. But, you know, we've seen also really incredible and powerful indigenous frontline resistance throughout construction. There's been numerous actions. At this point, probably around 700 people have been arrested resisting Line 3 at this point in nonviolent ways, both up north and in the Twin Cities. And, you know, we've seen so many people come from all across the country at this point for actions like the Treaty People Gathering and like last week's Treaties Not Tar Sands action that we had at the Minnesota State Capitol.
Tell me about that. Tell me about that. That sounds like it was
absolutely
fun, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. So
a kind of fun. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. It was really powerful. Yeah. So we are at the point again where it feels like, especially in Minnesota, our elected officials and our government agencies are simply not listening to us. We've made it so clear that we do not want this. We do not need more fossil fuels going into the economy. We do not need, you know, more fossil fuel infrastructure at this point, especially with all of the various harms to indigenous and frontline communities, both with construction and with operation and, you know, pipeline spills, as well as the climate impact. And so we've been trying to make it so clear that our elected officials need to take this seriously. But, you know, we've had to deal with so many issues with, you know, Governor Tim Walz and various state agencies more or less ignoring our voices, despite us, you know, making our points very clear and having, you know, the majority of the public on our side. They've still, you know, sold out and let the pipeline go through.
I see various kinds of tweets that said Governor Walz at some point said, if this pipeline crosses treaty lines, I'm going to stop it. And then he somehow forgot that he said that, or somehow that became a non-operative statement. Is that accurate?
Yeah, there is a tweet that I believe is still on his page from when he was campaigning to become governor that says any tar any pipeline through treaty lands is a non-starter. And if you, you know, do even like the basic research, you'll know that the pipeline endangers, you know, critical resources in the 1842, 1854, and 1855 treaty areas. And again, like there's been so much indigenous frontline resistance and outcry at this pipeline. So it's very clear that he has not followed through any of that promise.
Can you speak a little bit to the, it gets into probably complex history, but the 1854, these treaties, do you have like a thumbnail? Because most people, I mean, there are, of course, here in Massachusetts, we are all on occupied land also, right? There's, but I don't, we're not as, here, I guess things were, we didn't even get so far as a treaty, right? I mean, so tell me about the treaties that were signed, and I presume they still hold the force of law, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So I am not an expert on treaties, but I will say that, you know, these treaties are basically guaranteeing the Anishinaabe people the right to hunt and fish and, you know, gather like wildlife and all of these things that are, you know, important to their survival and, you know, culturally important as well. Like wild rice is sacred to their cultures. And, you know, these treaties guarantee those rights. And, you know, it is an agreement made between like the federal government and, you know, these sovereign nations. And so they should be, you know, the ultimate law of the land. And if you go to stopline3.org and, you know, look at the section with learning, you know, the information about this fight, you'll find so much more information on, really? You know, the treaties and various other issues. But
I think that from what I've seen, the question is that the pipeline not only disturbs these treaty lands, but also puts them at risk from a leak. Right? I mean, the old joke about there's two kinds of pipelines, one that has leaked and one that is going to leak, right? I mean, so these pipelines going through this pristine sovereign territory, I mean, that's a real problem, right? And in and of itself is probably a justification for stopping.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Enbridge itself is actually responsible for the largest inland oil spill in U.S. history. And so they do not have a good history at all with oil spills. They've had numerous oil spills on the previous Line 3. There's tons of concerns with the Line 5 pipeline in Michigan, mm-hmm. And various other projects that Enbridge has done. Like you said, every single pipeline spills, and that was even acknowledged in like the environmental impact statement that was done for this project. So it's very clear that this is going to be having, you know, huge impacts. And even while construction has been going on, there's been impacts to, you know, these wetlands, and Enbridge was actually given a permit to dewater 5 billion gallons of water while we were in the middle of a drought, which was 10 times the original amount. And it cost them around $150 to get that permit changed.
I saw that. Tell me, when you say dewater, what does that mean? Do you know? Can you say what that means?
Yeah. So the process of dewatering is basically just pumping the water out of a water body, like a marsh or a lake or something like that, putting the pipeline in, you know, keeping the water somewhere else, and then putting the water back. And they were allowed to do that with upward of 5 billion gallons. And, you know, they always say like, well, we treat the water and keep it safe and put it back. But, you know, you're dealing with a delicate ecosystem that, you know, if you take out the water that it needs to survive for any period of time, it's not going to do well.
I mean, all the little goldfish, did they all get to go along with the water? I mean, I didn't realize that somehow. Okay. So they're just basically pumping out a pond to put the pipe in and then put the water back in the pond and say, everything's fine. That's kind of crazy. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So I think, tell me, that what can people do? And I think that the question at this point is headed to the White House, right? And people outside of Minnesota, what's the leverage? What can people listening to this podcast do if they are interested in helping?
Absolutely. Yeah. So like I said before, this can feel like a pretty like local Minnesota issue, but it's important that we recognize like the broader both implications of, you know, breaking treaty law between the federal government and tribal governments, and, you know, the importance of uplifting, you know, indigenous sovereignty at a national level, and also the climate impacts. Line 3 is stated to have a climate impacts equivalent to building 50 new coal-fired plants, with a social cost of $187 billion over 30 years if they're allowed to operate that long.
That is because, tell me if this is correct, that is because the tar sands, this junky, poisonous tar sands that are going to go through that pipeline, that's going to get processed, which takes energy, and then the whole stuff's going to get burned again, the resulting fossil fuel, in quotation marks, that comes out of the tar sands gets burned, and that ends up being the equivalent of 50 power plants for the life of the power plant, which is an enormous amount of carbon, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we're moving so much, you know, carbon intensive fossil fuels that are going to be, you know, burned, and you know, we are at a point where we just can't be putting much more carbon into the atmosphere in general, and we're talking about, you know, building more pipelines that are going to make that so much easier, so much more cost effective, when we really need to be transitioning away from fossil fuels, you know, entirely. So I think that it's really important to uplift those, you know, the climate impacts and make this a national issue in general. I think always the first, the important first step is to educate yourself and educate your community. Again, making this an issue that people know about first and then that they care about, you know, both from the indigenous, you know, justice component and then also from the climate and environmental justice perspective. So,
and where can people go if they want to learn that? I think you said Stop Line 3. Yes. Is that what's the URL?
Yeah, it is www.stopline3.org. Has tons of great information as well as, you know, various other ways to get involved. Learning from that website, following, you know, various indigenous leaders and frontline resistance camps as well on social media can get you up to date information on how the on the ground fight has been going. Mm-hmm. And also just putting pressure on our, you know, elected officials, I think, especially like President Biden, who can at this point revoke the Army Corps of Engineers permit or the presidential permit, both of which would stop oil from flowing through his pipeline.
So I want to follow up on that. There were two things. One is the Army Corps of Engineers has issued a permit to operate, right? And Biden can just say, no, take that back, right? He has the authority to do that. And then the other one. Go ahead.
Yeah, basically, the Army Corps of Engineers permit is a water crossing permit. So Biden could do something very similar to what he did with the Dakota Access Pipeline just a couple months ago, where, you know, he revokes that permit and then orders or issues a federal environmental impact statement on this project. Because right now we've only done a Minnesota environmental impact statement. We haven't fully looked at, you know, the broad climate impacts, the cumulative impacts, the environmental justice impacts, the indigenous impacts that this pipeline will have from the federal level. So in a similar vein to DAPL, he could, you know, revoke that permit, stop construction while that is happening, and conduct a full federal environmental impact statement to really study these the effects of this pipeline.
And just this is probably before you were born, but in the early part of this millennia, there was a wind turbine farm proposed for just off of Cape Cod. It was called Cape Wind. And for the people listening to the show may remember it. There was a full, prolonged Army Corps of Engineers environmental impact statement that went on before the thing even, of course, and it was never built because there was so much opposition, but somebody, and I forget who was in president in 2004 or so, but they made sure that the Army Corps of Engineers looked closely at it, and the president could do that again, right? Have the Army Corps of Engineers take a second look at whether or not at a federal level, whether or not there's an environmental impact of this. So that's something, a specific thing that the president could do, right? And that people in Massachusetts could be asking him to do.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's that option. There's also the presidential permit, which is what allows oil to flow through the pipeline. Obviously, we want to, you know, stop it before that gets to that point. But if that permit is also revoked, then even if pipeline construction is complete, it can't flow oil while it's missing that permit. And on top of that, I think it's important to, you know, get some pressure from Congress as well. Like, we've had a number of congressional sign-on letters calling on Biden to revoke the federal permits. And so, you know, it's important that we both get the grassroots pressure and also from, you know, other elected officials from across the country, again, making this an issue that people care about and that our elected officials have to care about because people all across the country care about. So contacting your members of Congress, calling on them to, you know, pressure Biden to revoke the federal permits is also another option.
Super. Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, it's. You know, Joe Biden is at a pretty high, flying at a pretty high altitude, but your congressperson, and you call them up and they're listening and you tell them that, yeah, that's excellent. Excellent. Well, so I think, Sasha, you're making the case that this is a national issue. It may be being constructed in Minnesota, but it has national and indeed global implications, and that all of us from around the country ought to be paying attention because it matters, right? And that there are things that can be done even outside the state.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have, you know, had so many conversations about climate change in general, and this is just another one of those big climate bombs that is really going to have huge impacts if it is allowed to go through. And we know absolutely that it'll impact, you know, indigenous communities, frontline communities, low-income communities that, you know, don't have the ability to really secure their well-being in the future throughout the climate crisis. And so this is something that's going to have impacts all over the world if it's allowed to operate.
Right. And just to head off on that point for a little while, I mean, the environmental justice context of this whole thing, I mean, as climate activists, we talk about, you know, 50 power plants and all this kind of stuff. But I mean, what's happening is that this thing is being driven through some of the most disadvantaged people out there, right? And that, so the just, it, and it's a precedent, right? If we don't respect the standing of the people who have to live beside that pipeline, you're setting a precedent for all kinds of other stuff. And it's, you know, it's a good place to have the fight to make that case in real time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we've seen that precedent be sent so many times already throughout this country's history. Like, indigenous communities have had to bear so many environmental consequences from various projects throughout this nation's history because of, you know, the way that we treat them, especially through like regulatory process and breaking treaties and all of that. So mm-hmm. this is really trying to stop that pretty disgusting history that has left these communities so disadvantaged and has hurt them so much and, you know, has disrespected their cultural values as well. Gone against the ultimate law of the land being treaties. So we really want to, you know, set a much better precedent by saying no pipelines through treaty lands, no pipelines in general, of course, but this pipeline in particular that is, you know, directly in, you know, the communities of indigenous people that will threaten their wild rice and threaten their resources and their livelihoods. Is a non-starter, and you know, we cannot allow it to finish, to operate any of that.
That's great. Wow. Well, that's a fascinating perspective, Sasha. Thank you so much. What we'll do is we'll put up links to various things, in particular to stopline3.org, which is a good place to go to learn about this stuff. Those hot links will be on the MCAN blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. So you can go there to find that stuff. If you have a suggestion about a future show, something other stuff we should be talking about, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what's good and bad about the show, et cetera, et cetera. We want to hear from you. You're probably listening to this show on your smartphone using Stitcher or one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their favorite modern podcast distribution app. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions. They will accept responsibility for building a durable future. That we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects the communities most impacted by such a carbon price. If we do those things, we'll safeguard our collective future. So, Sasha, thank you so much for being here. It's been fascinating. I really appreciate your insight.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.